Blog Talk Radio.
What difference if I hail from north or south, or from the east or west? My heart is filled with love for all of thee. I only know I swell with pride and deep within my breast I thrill to see, O glory faint, the breeze.
Happening today. I'll start with the birthdays. Some interesting people were born on this date, March 25th. One of the greatest Italian conductor. He was also a composer, cello player. Arturo Toscanini was born today. He was known for his literal translation, following the printed note on the page. He had many fights with conductors like Wilhelm Furtwängler, who liked to improvise, Leopold Stokowski, people like that. He's the guy that had fights with many a diva and soloists, and even some of his own players. He would go into a rage if he didn't like to play. He once smashed a violin over a violinist's head. He couldn't get away with that today with the unions. Also, I repeated this about Geraldine Ferrard, excuse me. He was conducting a performance, and she was the vocal soloist, and he stopped her for a point of interpretation, and she said haughtily, "Maestro, here I am the star." Toscanini closed his eyes, raised his head to heaven, shook his white hair, said, "Madam, the only stars I know are in heaven," and that shut her up. But he was so good that RCA Victor, then run by David Sarnoff, who incidentally was the guy who took the telegraph messages of distress involving the British ship, the White Star ship Titanic, when it struck that iceberg. He later founded the RCA Victor Corporation. They made a lot of records, and their most famous symbol is Nipper, the dog who's listening in front of that the old phonograph horn. And they set up a special orchestra of the top musicians for Arturo Toscanini, who conducted around the world. He made his debut in, I think, Brazil, when the conductor was screwing up on a performance of Aida. The conductor was booed off the stage, and somebody said, "Arturo," he was a 21-year-old cellist in this orchestra that was touring South America. And they said, "You get on the podium, you know the music." And so he conducted Aida. They made a movie with, guess who? Elizabeth Taylor as Aida. She just died the other day. We'll get into her background and Senator John Warner in the Steve Murray case, which is featured this week also. because Senator John Warner also was a U.S. Navy sailor. He was Secretary of the Navy, and he was Steve Nary's relatives were constituents of his. And Warner was asked when he was U.S. Senator to investigate the case or get a congressional investigation. We were told, as the legal liaison for Nary, for the sailor, that the word was not to deal with this case, and the aide slammed the phone down. So that's what happened there. I guess Warner didn't have any cojones, and that's why she divorced him. Anyway, a lot of people don't know that her mother was American, but she had that English accent, and of course, a lot of people thought she was super bitch. But now, other birthdays today, the great Aretha Franklin, who incidentally sang an operatic aria from Turandot, the Puccini's last opera, which Toscanini conducted the premiere on, and he didn't complete it. Puccini died before the opera was completed, so Toscanini conducted the premiere and stopped the performance when at the unfinished part of Puccini's score. The next day, Toscanini was also he was an arranger. He rearranged it, and Alfano, another Italian composer, finished the parts to the great opera Turandot. But Aretha Franklin did sing this at a pop concert, and it was great. We don't have I couldn't find a recording in our archives, but maybe we'll play it next week. Also, Anita Bryant, the orange who's hustling Florida oranges and got into controversy with the crotch politics crowd. They really trashed her for her views on homosexuality and lesbianism. And then here's another feminist. Gloria Steinem was born today. And, of course, so she's moderated her views somewhat. Unfortunately, we've seen on Hannity's show yesterday this teacher at Occidental College, who was also a Democratic Party strategist. She didn't reveal this. And she was trashing people who are raising questions about Obama's failure to produce a certified, verifiable birth certificate. And she made such outrageous, racist remarks. And we looked her up, and her students, she teaches political science to freshmen, but some of these freshmen are pretty savvy, and they're scathing reviews of her teaching, her bullying, her refusal to entertain or respect other people's views. Some people like her, the true believers, but overall, apparently she is an ideologue in the classroom, and it's unfortunate that she's dealing with impressionable students like college freshmen, who are generally politically naive but idealistic. Of course, some people have shown that they see right through her phony professional teaching veneer. But she should identify herself as a Democratic Party strategist, and also she's involved with this Critical Mass, which is that outfit, this anarchist outfit on bicycles that used to block traffic on the last Friday of the month. This would happen today in San Francisco and other cities, I guess, where they, at rush hour, they would clog the freeway, the entrance to the freeways and the streets. Emergency vehicles could not get through. Some of them were running around butt naked. And it went on for a couple hours, and it almost got to fisticuffs in a couple of situations. They haven't done this in a long time, and I hope they cease and desist forever. As you know, all these bicycle lanes are being installed or painted on the roadway, but yet these bicyclists are not insured. They don't contribute to the economy unless they're a bicycle messenger, and that's a dying occupation and a very dangerous one to begin with. They don't contribute to the economy. They don't have licenses. They don't have insurance. A lot of these people, they get into accidents, and if the other party has insurance, the injured party, that person's insurance pays for the medical bills and the damage to the injured person who's been hit by a bicyclist. They do not obey the stop signs, the traffic laws, the rules of the road. They want everything, but they pay nothing. So we'll get into that another day, because we think that bicyclists should be there are a few states that do require them to get a bicycle license and put it on their bicycle. Also, safety devices, like years ago when you had the tricycles, you had a little bell that rang, and I think in some of them they had lights, and these people ride around on these bicycles at dusk, and when it's dark, you can't see them. But if you hit them and you've got auto insurance, your auto insurance pays, not them. And they don't get a ticket. You do. And then the deaths today, we have, let's see, events, excuse me. We have the, in 1807, the British Parliament abolished, prohibited the slave trade, and the last country in the world to stop the to abolish the slave trade was Portugal and Brazil in the late 1800s. Also, Brazil, as most of the people there, are mixed, and they would be, and maybe that's why Obama was so popular down there. Incidentally, about 30 years ago, there was a book written by a novelist down there who, in his book, he had predicted that the United States would have a black president. He was off by maybe nearly 100 years, not quite 80 years, because Warren G. Harding was the first president who was accused of having Negro blood. That was the what they said at the time, and there seemed to be some pictures to back this up, some seven cuts and cousins and everything, and we'll get into that another day. However, Warren Harding said, look, I can't help it if some of my ancestors jumped over the back fence. And, of course, there's a term called high yeller and octoroon, and one drop of Negro blood, as it was called, made you a black. I mean, all these stupid racist remarks. And then we have these stupid women like this Caroline Hellman, a teacher at Occidental College, accusing people who are questioning Obama's failure to produce a birth certificate, accusing them of racism, of white, and then this stupid, she said it, and then Whoopi Goldberg O'Connor showed herself to be increasingly vulgar and crass. It's a shame because that woman did initially raise herself up by her bootstraps. Now she's just gotten to be fat and sassy, fat and scathing for no reason, opinionated, and shown her ignorance of history, saying that you wouldn't ask a white man for his birth certificate. Yet Harding was asked about it, and of course the black blood allegation or accusation. And then of course there's the case of Chester Arthur, whose father emigrated from Ireland to Canada. Chester was supposed to have been born in Quebec, I believe. Then he went down to Vermont. Then he got involved as the custom house of New York City, or the custom collector, which was one of the biggest sources of graft at the time. And then he became the vice president in the, I think, the Garfield administration. Garfield was assassinated, and then Arthur became president. Arthur, he had these big mutton chops on his face, and there was a term called term at the time called Arthurian, and it was used to describe him. However, that term has gone into the verbal dustbin of history. Also today, we had Pope Pius IX, Roman Catholic Pope, wrote an encyclical calling on aid for Ireland. I haven't seen the encyclical, but I thought I'd bring it up. And then the in 1900, the first modern Olympics in 1896 was revived in Greece by Baron de Coppetier. And in fact, I had to write a paper for college on that for my exercise class. And in 1900, the American version of the Socialist Party was started. They're now, quote, progressive communists. But that's what the Socialist Party has become, or Democratic Socialist is another name they use. And then we had in 1931 a trial as bad as the Steve Neary trial. Several black boys were in the South, in Alabama, were riding the rails like a lot of kids were during the Depression, looking for work. And there was a white girl in the boxcar with them. She accused them of rape. It was a false, or she was set up to it. In those days, the cops, the police, and the local authorities in rural areas would arrest these youths as vagrants. And in fact, they put them on the chain gang. They were horribly. It was a horrible case of a kid who was whipped practically to death and was paralyzed the rest of his life. He was from Illinois, and I'll get into that case another day. Anyway, the Scottsboro Boys were railroaded by the Alabama authorities, and it became a cause celeb case. A Jewish lawyer working for the American Civil Liberties Union came down from New York. It took many years before the Scottsboro Boys were exonerated, that they didn't touch this young white girl. But this is what goes on, and now we have horrible cases of heterosexuals being being preyed upon by sexual predators like Juan P. Ferre, Hennessy, Brian Hennessy in San Jose. That case was censored and suppressed about the same time. You had this Matthew Shepard from a wealthy oil family in Wyoming, where there are several reports that he used to sexually harass other young males. In fact, a Latino kid and him got into a fight, and the kid had himself tested for AIDS. We don't know if Matthew Shepard had AIDS or a communicable disease. It was reported that he picked it up in North Africa when his family was over there doing oil in the oil business. Also, one of the kids, the youths who killed him, was bisexual or homosexual and reportedly had a relationship with Matthew Shepard. And that whole Matthew Shepard crotch politics trial and publicity was about a drug deal gone bad, not about homophobia. They use that as a political cudgel, just like the Nazis use the Jews to run through their laws and to drive the Jews out of Germany and into the concentration camps, the ones who couldn't get out of the country. And even the ones who fled to Holland and countries that later became occupied, when the German army conquered those countries or those countries surrendered, the Gestapo went in there with a list of Jews. And then the ones they found, they deported to Auschwitz and Belsen, Treblinka, and all those places. So there's a lot more to the Nazis and homosexuality and the predators in their ranks. And then in 1954, getting back to RCA Victor again, David Sarnoff, I think, was still living. They produced the first color TV. It was 12.5 inches. That's what the screen was. And then getting back to Nazi Germany in 1965, Germany extended the war crimes retribution so that anybody who was victimized by the Nazis could make a claim, and there's still claims going on. And we think that money stolen and assets stolen by the Nazis and those who escaped to South America, like Argentina, put that money in the vaults of the Bank de Provincia, the province of Buenos Aires. And that bank was the family bank of Juan Jorge Prefere, the homosexual predator, who not only preyed on people like Steve Neri, the 18-year-old boy, but other, and I'm quoting his friends, other white, young white boys, and in particular military recruits. Since the world is in a turmoil, I think it's appropriate to play this clip from Dr. Albert Schweitzer, who did so much to relieve suffering in Africa and lepers. And he was also not only a great Protestant preacher, but he was also a humanitarian. He was also a organ virtuoso. And he was particularly fond of Johann Sebastian Bach, whose birthday was this week. And the theme I'm going to play is often used in these horror films. So here goes Bach's Toccata and Fugue, played by Dr. Albert Schweitzer. I think we have another verse. Mm-hmm. That was an old recording, and of course you hear the noise in the background, and I think Dr. Schweitzer died in 1965. Now here's another recording, and it's a beautiful hymn. It's sung by one of the greatest German opera singers, Lotte Lehmann, who used to teach after she retired from the operatic stage, and she moved to Southern California. And this is a prayer that a lot of people should be praying, those who believe in God or should believe in God. Mighty Fortress Is Our God, played by Albert Schweitzer and sang by Lotte Lehmann. That's one of the more popular, most popular Protestant hymns. I think they even sing it in some Catholic churches. Ein Feste Burg, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, came from the archives that we put together at Western Public Radio and KLW and the Carson Brazola Audio Visual Print Historical Archives. One of the questions that some people, political cognoscenti, are starting to ask is how many unpublicized nuclear waste dumps sites are here in the United States. After World War II, and I asked Leo Lee, who was one of San Francisco's last real journalist editors, started the call bulletin, and then he was the press secretary, he was a Democrat, for Governor Goodwin Knight, who was the successor to Earl Warren when Eisenhower appointed him to be Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Warren exactly was family was Scandinavian, and of course a lot of people anglicized their names. Interestingly, Warren's grandson, James Warren, was one of the judges in the Kangaroo Court case involving the District Attorney of San Francisco and 18-year-old Stephen Neri. They used Warren, who was gay, during Gay Pride Month or Gay Orgy Month in June of 1999. The case was then, Neri removed the case, filed papers to remove the case to the proper jurisdiction of the U.S. District Court, Ninth Circuit here in San Francisco. It was defied by the prosecutor, Terrence Hallinan, and homosexuals in his office. This is one of the scandals that's going to break any day, and it's going to be like a tsunami, a political tsunami, with all the people, the names of all the people who are identified, and the allegations are not allegations, they're accusations, and they are credible. But anyway, getting back to the nuclear waste issue, I asked Leo Lee, when I was at Western Public Radio before he died, I keep hearing that there are nuclear waste sites here in San Francisco and in Northern California. I said, what happened to the nuclear waste after they created the atomic bombs at Oak Ridge, Tennessee? Well, we know that Hanford, Washington probably has gotten the most publicity about nuclear waste. And remember, there was a governor who was later head of the Atomic Energy Committee, and a lot of people thought she was a lesbian, Dixie Ray Lee. Remember her? She lived in a trailer with her two dogs, and she was, pro-nuclear waste, nuclear energy. She's dead now. Then I was told also, and I've asked other people, that some of that nuclear waste, it was spread around the country, and nobody thought about it, the dangers at that time. And some of that waste was supposedly buried on the lakefront in Chicago, and, of course, it's sealed with concrete. Also, some of that waste, and of course the first nuclear reaction, atomic reaction, was at the University of Chicago, which is in Hyde Park, where Obama did live. And the University of Chicago had a football stadium, and this guy Alonzo Stagg was the great football player coach. And when Robert Maynard Hutchins became the president, he abolished football. And so what happened was the Enrico Fermi and some other scientists, Fermi was also Italian of Jewish heritage, conducted experiments under the stands at Stagg Field in Hyde Park, University of Chicago. That was where the first nuclear or the first atomic reaction, whatever you want to call it. We don't know what they did with that nuclear waste. But here on the coast of California off of San Francisco, about 25 miles off, it's a place called the Farallon Islands. After World War II and during the 50s, the Navy and the Atomic Energy Commission dumped barrels, 32-gallon drums of nuclear waste into the ocean, and which is Farallon Islands, about 25 miles off Ocean Beach. And we'll put this up because that's also where the Beta Breakers ends up when they run the race in May. And we'll get into that next week because there may be some changes, and there should be. Anyway, and not only, and then there was a ship that carried this stuff that was sunk down there in those waters. Also, because another ship sank there, it was carrying a load of wine. That is the oldest winery in California. I don't know who designated it as such, but that was it. Also, there's a site where farmers come for years to bring their produce on Saturday called Farmers Market. And there was a hill there, which now has, which underneath has two or three active streams. The Obayashi, the Japanese alleged Yakuza construction company, along with a guy named Roberts, who may be the front man, constructed a housing project, an affordable housing project, so-called, on that site, which supposedly houses, is buried nuclear waste. There's also nuclear waste at the Hunters Point Naval Base, which the Navy gave San Francisco $500 million to clean up. We don't know if there's ever been an audit of that money and how much of that nuclear waste has been safely cleaned up. There are other problems out there because that base has been in operation for 100 years. So these are some of the issues. And then the Department of Energy, which handles the issues about atomic energy, reports there are 131 or 130 sites, known sites, excuse me, across the United States. How many of these are on earthquake faults or could be hit by a tsunami? Now, Ocean Beach is when they had the Japanese earthquake and tsunami, they closed Ocean Beach. We have videos of that because the fear that the tsunami would reach San Francisco's shores, Ocean Beach, and up the coast. Some of it hit Santa Clara, Santa Cruz, which is like 25 miles down the coast, destroyed some boats. It also hit in Northern California, another section, and of course it did damage in Hawaii. So, and then we've already had a major earthquake in 1989, and we're scheduled for another one because the area is on three faults. And according to some seismologists, there is another fault coming down that extends from British Columbia right down the California coast. If a tsunami and an earthquake occur at the same time, this could be devastating because all of that nuclear waste could possibly be washed up under the western shores of San Francisco City and County, as well as along the California coast. And if those barrels are washed up and they're floating around, who knows where they'll end up. And if they, some of them are already rusting and rotting and leaking that stuff. And we don't know what the radiation level is and how the fish have been affected, if they have been. We think they have been. Now going back to, we raised the issue about Japan and their nuclear reactors and the construction of those nuclear power plants. The issue is, who built those reactors, who checked them, who constantly monitored them to see that they were safe and they were able to withstand an earthquake, presumably a tsunami, and who constructed the nuclear power station. And we find out that these reactors may have been defective from the beginning when they were installed. And they were sold to Tokyo Electric and other Japanese electric companies, and they knew that these were inferior, substandard nuclear reactors, which didn't have enough safety devices built in to prevent a nuclear catastrophe like as what the Japanese are experiencing right now. Also, according to some credible journalists working in Japan on public radio today, surprisingly, they report that there had been an incestuous relationship between the Japanese nuclear regulators who oversee that industry and those power plants and the operators of the power plants. So a lot of things got, I won't say shoved under the rug, but got buried. And now they've been unearthed with this earthquake, tsunami, and this contamination is worse than Chernobyl. Incidentally, here in San Francisco, in another affordable housing huge project, which has some retired Russian military in their what we call their bricklayer wives, a couple of them, I'm told, are refugees from the Chernobyl area and Siberia. Also, that site, when the 1989 earthquake occurred, it's a block-long site, a unitary structure. The whole block collapsed, and this housing project is built on sand and clay. It was recorded by Ian Donald Turner. He's the guy who was in the plane with Ron Brown when it went down in Croatia. And, of course, when we saw the manifest, we were saying, what's this guy doing on that plane? Well, he was the guy, his bridge housing, what was also known as the Path to Graft, was the outfit that put that project together. They recorded the subsurface of the land. So if they're sued, if his successors are sued, they can say, hey, we didn't disclose anything, it's recorded. But of course, who's going to go research property and surveyors' records? So they think they're off the hook. Now, the other thing is, discuss this with sailors and other military people and veterans who were in Japan. If a federal military person is injured or killed while on active duty, or even while in the service on the rolls, he or she cannot sue the government under a legal decision by the United States Supreme Court called the Freres, F-R-E-R-E-S. It's ironic because Freres is French for brother. People like Birnbaum, not Birnbaum, but the Veterans for Constitutional Rights, Art Brinclaw, who's been actively trying to get that Supreme Court decision reversed by United States Congress, which is the premier authority for jurisdiction over the federal military. Excuse me, I still have this cold. Anyway, it hasn't succeeded so far. And then there's the Solario, which is another case. But anyway, the issue is if American diplomats or servicemen who are serving in Japan or in that area, if they are infected with nuclear contamination and are sick, can they sue the Japanese government or the people who put those reactors in, who's responsible for those reactors that have that are now gone amok? So that's the question. And of course, I was told by Navy JAG that you have to look at the statute, the status of forces agreements. These are individual treaties with countries where the United States has military personnel. And of course, there's another issue. It's called the jurisdiction of the flag, that if a host country allows a foreign military to be in their country or to pass through, then the foreign military does not give up jurisdiction over its own military that happened to be in a foreign country at that time. And this is an issue that will come up in it's related to the Steve Neri case, 16-year case that's cost the American public an estimated $15 to $16 million. $10 million of it was spent on a huge housing project, which is now falling apart, built with American taxpayer money, $10 million of that. So we'll get into that. And then the remaining costs were all the people involved in the Steve Neri kangaroo court prosecution. They range from three or four departments of the federal government, people in Congress who've had to take time to work on this, state of California people, employees, the courts in the state of California, the San Francisco Superior Court, the California Appellate Court, District 1, and the California State Supreme Court. Then there's the federal courts, the Ninth Circuit District Court, Court of Appeal, and the U.S. Supreme Court. So we'll get into all that. All these people that I mentioned, all these various departments and government entities, people have spent time on this case, and of course that costs money. They needed to get paid, and correspondence and all that is costly. It wasn't for free. So that's the issue there. Since we're this Sunday we're going to do a special program. We may get into the nuclear issue in the Balkans. A legal immigrant from Yugoslavia, he's Yugoslavian, will be my guest, and we'll be talking about the situation in the Balkans. And he was drafted in the Yugoslav army when Josip Broz Tito was the president dictator of Yugoslavia. That country has since been broken up. So the working title is, what would Tito do if he were due in the Balkans, if he was still the president of Yugoslavia? So we'll be talking about that, and there's a lot of information, historical facts that very few Americans know about, which are very relevant about, there's controversy over the pipeline, and that's one of the reasons that Ron Brown may have been over there, and also Ian Donald Taylor, Turner, and also there was a plane, some people from Enron was supposed to be on that plane with Ron Brown, but they decided to take another plane, and they survived when that plane crashed into that mountain outside that airport in Croatia, I think. So he will be my guest Sunday morning at 10 a.m. It'll be an hour interview, live interview. You can call in. And so we'll be putting that up. Since we have a little more time and I've got a horse, I'm going to play some more. One of the big issues, and it's ridiculous because it may be the intrusion onto the religious freedoms of Jews and other people who believe in circumcision. We'll play this one. Is circumcision the unkindest cut of all? This is an archival interview that we had at the station.
Marilyn, you were a student nurse when you saw your first circumcision. Can you tell us exactly what you saw?
Walking into the room, there was a baby strapped to a plastic board, which is called a circumstraint, across the room on a countertop. His arms and legs were, he was strapped spread eagle, and he was pulling at his restraints. I asked my instructor if I could help him because he was fretting, and she said, no, wait until the doctor gets here. And then I sort of felt sick to my stomach, wondering why I wasn't allowed to go and give comfort to this little baby that was struggling so much. I looked back to see where the doctor was, and he was doing a scrub of his hands and telling dirty jokes to the nurses. And I might say that telling dirty jokes is not an uncommon practice during a circumcision. When he came into the room, I asked him if I could go and comfort the child, and he said, certainly, and put my finger into his baby's mouth and began to stroke his little head, and he began to suckle and quieted down. The nurse had already prepared the baby by giving him a surgical scrub, a five-minute scrub, which in fact makes his little penis erect. And so this now is his first shared sexual experience. And the next thing that happened was to put a drape over the baby's abdomen with has a hole in it out of which the baby's penis protrudes. And the doctor took a Kelly clamp of a, it looks like a scissors, but it was not for cutting but for clamping, and grabs a hold of the foreskin. At that point, the baby let out a shriek. The doctor then put another clamp on the other side of his foreskin. The baby continued to scream. Then the doctor took a probe and forced it between the foreskin and the glands, separating these two structures, which are normally attached at birth for the protection of the baby's genitals. This is mother's nature's way of making sure that the glands isn't affected by urine and feces during infancy while the baby's urinating and defecating on himself. So the doctor moved the probe around underneath the foreskin, literally skinning the penis alive as the foreskin was torn from the glands. Then he crushed the foreskin lengthwise, where he then cut. The crushing is to keep the blood vessels from, crushes the blood vessels and keeps the baby from bleeding too much then. So that's then where he cuts. That opens the opening of the foreskin enough so that they can insert the circumcision device. The device is then put into place between the foreskin and the glands. And the purpose of this device is to keep the head of the penis from being severed during the surgery. And so when the device is in place, the doctor then crushes the foreskin down upon that. The whole time, of course, the baby is screaming and shaking the head back and forth, basically because that's the only part of his body he can move. At that point, they crush the foreskin and ultimately amputate it.
This is About Men, a monthly magazine on KUSP, presented by Barry Boland and myself, Jeff Harrit. Circumcision may be on the decline, but it is still performed on over half the baby boys born in this country. As recently as the 1960s, it was performed almost as a matter of course. The practice of circumcision has its origins in prehistory. It has been performed around the world in both sexes. It takes and has taken many forms, and has been performed for a wide variety of reasons, religious, cultural, and medical. Joining us in the studio today are two noted circumcision activists. Before we introduce them, though, it is worth noting that we invited and attempted to invite several people to give the case for circumcision. However, for a variety of reasons, including sabbatical, vacation, and unwillingness, none were able to make it. Jim Bigelow is a psychologist and an ordained minister, author of the forthcoming book, The Joy of Uncircumcising. Marilyn Marlos is a registered nurse and mother of three circumcised boys. She's the founder and director of NoCirc, the National Organization of Circumcision Information Resource Centers. Marilyn has also organized two international symposia on the subject. Marilyn and John, welcome to KUSP, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and thank you for addressing this important human rights issue.
Okay. One thing that struck me when you were describing, Marilyn, the first time you saw a circumcision was the lack of anesthesia. Why isn't anesthetic used?
They are beginning to use it. For years, they thought babies didn't feel pain, and of course, we now know that this is ridiculous, and so there is some concern, and babies are becoming, or doctors are beginning to use an anesthetic. It's important for us, however, not to anesthetize ourselves, thinking that babies don't feel pain when they are, just because they've gotten anesthetic on board. They're using a penile dorsal nerve block, which means they make two injections at the base of the baby's penis, and then the anesthetic is administered. It may or may not work, and if it does work, the baby's relieved for a little while during the actual amputation of the foreskin. But, of course, the moment that this subsides, then he still urinates and defecates into a raw wound for a week or 10 days while that circumcision site is healing and suffers the pain of it, not to mention the lifelong consequences.
Now, if one is to be circumcised as a child or an adult, anesthesia is used there.
Yes, yes. We'll be only beginning now in America to address the issue of the child's rights to anesthetic, just as adults. In fact, babies feel pain much more dramatically than adults do.
How do you know that?
A special study was done by Anand and Hickey some years ago. A woman by the name of Jill Lawson understood that her baby who had open heart surgery had that done to him without an anesthetic, and the baby died, and she blew the whistle on what was being done to babies in America. So a special study was done, it came out in 1987, and the parameters that they used dealt with looking at babies who were undergoing circumcision to determine whether or not they were in fact feeling pain, and of course now we know that they are. Wouldn't you stick a diaper pin into a baby and the baby screams? You know babies feel pain. It was amazing to me that it took all of this time to come to. We had to go through scientific studies to gain common sense.
Jim, would it make any difference to you if circumcision was performed regularly with general anesthetic?
No, it would make no difference at all. As a psychologist, I'm very aware of body image. Also as a husband of a wife who died of cancer and who lost her breast before she died, I'm very aware that amputation does some very traumatic things to body image. Now, interestingly enough, if you talk about a woman losing a breast, or if you talk about the amputation even of a little finger, one understands that would cause the individual at least some amount of anguish and the need to adjust. We've been taking off foreskins in this country for 100 years en masse without any concern at all that the male might feel some sense of loss. In fact, we trivialize and laugh at it and imagine that this should have no consequence at all. We're only beginning to hear from men who say, I don't like what they did to me. I don't like looking at that scar every time I take a shower and change my clothes.
Now, Marilyn, sometimes, of course, a little bit more than the foreskin ends up being removed. There are complications, I understand, sometimes when circumcision is involved. Setting aside any psychological trauma.
Yes, certainly. Circumcision is a surgical procedure, so it has risks like any other surgery, and they include hemorrhage, infection, mutilation, and death. And we've only begun to hear the consequences, the mutilating effects of circumcision in this country from men who are finally able to have the courage and to come out and talk about what's happened to them. We don't know how often complications occur because no one keeps records. We're doing 1.25 million surgeries on a tiny piece of tissue, and you just have to know that there are a lot of botched jobs, and up to and including death.
Now,
babies have lost their penises from this.
Yes, 1.25 million a year.
1.25 million a year, yes.
And how many of those...
Only in America.
Okay, and how many of those are losing their penis or something equally traumatic? Perhaps?
Well, in 1985, we know that two babies lost their penis on the same day in Atlanta, Georgia, during a circumcision. Probably, to me, the greatest example of adding insult to injury is that they took one of those boys and turned him into a little girl, as if he didn't have a Y chromosome, trying to make it better, I suspect. Babies do die. Again, we have no idea. You see, on the death certificate, they can say, well, the baby died of infant blood dysgrazia. That might mean that the baby was had some kind of bleeding disorder, and they wouldn't say, oh, secondary to circumcision. A baby might die of an infection, but they wouldn't say, oh, he died of an infection because of circumcision. They would just say, well, he had sepsis. So so it's clouded. We have no idea.
Jim, how can these mistakes be made, such as removing the whole penis as opposed to just the foreskin? Well, the particular ones that Marilyn is talking about have happened because of electrocautery devices improperly used, where quite, not to be crude, but quite literally the penis was zapped with electricity until it fried and atrophied. And it was simply, and interestingly enough, I have a book entitled The Male, in which the gentleman who has written the book, the doctor, is very much in favor of infant circumcision, but he describes in great detail five very serious mutilations that happened on a single day when a new intern rotated into the nursery. And he simply says, you have to understand, this is very rare, and the doctor who did it was truly good-hearted. Now,
tell that to the babies.
Now, good-hearted doctors or not, it's very difficult to ask the consent of a newly born infant for performing such an operation. What are the consent issues here?
Well, you've touched the basic prime issue here, because when we do talk about consent, who has a right to consent? If you don't have a right to your body, what do you have a right to? So when we talk about consent, the only person who really has the right to consent to foreskin amputation is the person whose foreskin it is. And however, in this country, we think it's okay to spank babies. We think that we have control over the children's bodies or children's lives. And parents haven't come yet to the realization, nor have doctors, that we don't have a right to make an informed this kind of a consent for our children. In the hospital, supposedly they're supposed to have an informed consent. For the most part, parents have no idea about some very important issues. For example, the foreskin is normal, healthy, functioning tissue, and that there are risks, and that it's a painful surgery, and that it leaves both physical and psychological scars, or that it is the child's choice. So these are all things that we're trying to take into account and get people, educate the public, so that they have an understanding of what constitutes an informed consent.
Are consent forms always signed?
Not necessarily, no. There are lots of times, and sometimes, I was an expert witness on a lawsuit last year where parents signed three different times on the consent form to say, no, we do not want to have our baby circumcised, and the baby was circumcised. That little boy just won $60,000. It's not much today, but maybe with interest it'll grow.
Ownership is something that really is has a long history in this country. If you think about it, we were founded as a nation at a time when we believed that one human being could own another if his skin were a different color. Then we went through a long period of time where a wife was essentially a property, and by the extension, so were the children. And so bit by bit, a nation that really prides itself on human rights is beginning to understand that individual human beings are the only exercise the only true ownership of the body and of the person. And children now are the last of that whole spectrum to come into consideration. We still consider the child the property of the parent, and therefore the parent can order things done to that child. And that's something that we really are going to have to think through as a nation, because in the case of circumcision, it means that they have the right to have a perfectly normal, healthy part of an organ of the body that we now know is an incredibly sensual and sensing organ with more nerves than the glands of the penis. They can order that removed by just the stroke of a pen.
And what does it cost these parents, on average, to have a circumcision done on their baby boy?
Well, it's about $100. Depends on where, and it varies from state to state, or even from hospital to hospital. The estimate is that it's $250 million industry.
Which is an interesting point, Jeff,
because you see in other countries where when circumcision began in the English speaking countries, initially to prevent masturbation, and it's adopted one medical excuse after another to perpetuate it. But in the other English-speaking countries, for example, in England, when the health care providers stopped paying for it, circumcision plummeted. A study came out in 1949 by Dr. Douglas Gairdner, who said circumcision isn't necessary, the foreskin is normal, healthy, what are we doing by cutting off all of these babies' foreskins? And the British Health Service, which had been instituted a year earlier, said, well, let's stop paying for it. And within 3 years, the circumcision rate went from something like 80% down to less than 1%. It's less than 0.5% today. Now, that's an interesting point, because that means circumcision stopped 40 years ago in England without the dire consequences the American medical community will lead us to believe will happen to our sons if we leave them intact.
Well, it's an issue in San Francisco. They're trying to put it on a ballot to ban circumcision, and of course, this is going to be interesting with the rabbis and other people who have an agenda. It's interesting that it's at San Francisco General Hospital. Circumcision rates have dropped. Now, the other thing that people aren't looking at is we're going to get some kind of health care plan. It's just that the Obamacare is just such a mess. It'll be interesting to see, since there's going to be managed care, and what will this be? Will circumcision be covered under any new medical plans? So Sunday we're going to have a special program with a legal immigrant who's formerly in the Yugoslav Army. He's from Yugoslavia, and the title is "What Would Tito Do with the Balkans if he was still alive today?" So we'll end with our usual theme: politics and poker. So tune in Sunday at 10 o'clock Pacific Standard Time for an hour interview with one of Tito's former citizens.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bet.
Cost you five. Pony, up to you.
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too. Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year. Big Ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where's the sound?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible states, possible flesh. Nothing. Gentlemen, how about the names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
How's it going? We should make Jack Riley a guy.
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y? I say neither one. I never even met him.
I say when you got a pair of Jack, better.
Politics and poker, politics and poker, shuffle up and cards and find the joke.
Politics or poker, which is more important?
Paratrace.
Yep, good night, folks. We'll be back on a special show Sunday, 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Good night.